KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
What Trump is doing in the U.S. is not acceptable. His office has played a role, it's undeniable, in the release of the hostages.
Hamas has released a U.S.-Israeli hostage who had been held in Gaza since 2023.
From Monday, May 12th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump heads to the Middle East tonight, where he will visit Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates.
He's been facing scrutiny over Qatar's offer to replace Air Force One with a luxury Boeing 747 jet.
I mean, I could be a stupid person, say, no, we don't want a free, very expensive airplane.
And in Texas, the state's lottery system is under investigation after jackpot controversies and multiple resignations.
Governor Abbott and I both asked for Texas Ranger investigations, and they are currently going on. The question is, should the Texas lottery continue?
First, these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. 59 Afrikaners landed at Dulles International Airport today. They are the first group of white South Africans to be granted refugee status in the U.S. NPR's Amanda Bastillo has more.
Children held American flags and stuffed animals. They gathered in one blocked-off corner of the airport hangar decorated with red, white, and blue balloons. Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau greeted them.
It makes me so happy to see you with our flag.
The administration says these families, who are descendants of Dutch settlers, face the threat of violence because of their race. They granted the families an expedited process to seek refuge. The broader refugee program effectively remains paused, but the administration says more Afrikaners are set to arrive in the coming months. Ximena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
House Republicans are wrangling over the nuts and bolts of how President Donald Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill might work. The measure contains Trump's tax cuts, which include boosting deductions, but how to pay for it is the multi-trillion dollar question. Current funding proposal includes reductions to Medicaid, green energy, and other programs, but NPR's Deidre Walsh says there is disagreement.
Not all Republicans think that they should be doing these major changes to Medicaid. One of them, Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley, wrote an editorial in the New York Times today criticizing some in his party who he says want to slash health care for the working poor. He called that move, quote, both morally wrong and politically suicidal.
House Speaker Mike Johnson has said he hopes to get the House to vote on a final bill before the Memorial Day recess. President Trump has named his former personal defense attorney to be the new acting librarian of Congress. NPR's Netta Ulubi reports Todd Blanche will replace Carla Hayden, who the president fired last week.
Todd Blanche has no experience working in libraries or archives. Now he will be in charge of the largest one in the world. Blanche will be coming over from the Justice Department, where the president had appointed him as Deputy Attorney General. Blanche led the defense in a trial Trump lost when he was found guilty last year of lying about paying hush money to an adult film star. The announcement was confirmed by a Library of Congress employee who wished to remain anonymous to avoid retribution. The permanent post of Librarian of Congress must be confirmed by the Senate. Netta Ulubi, NPR News.
A judge is refusing to block the IRS from sharing tax data to identify and deport people in the U.S. illegally. The decision is a win for the Trump administration, which has said it wants to share the tax data with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The judge denied a preliminary injunction today in a lawsuit filed by nonprofit groups. They'd argued immigrants who pay U.S. taxes are entitled to the same privacy as U.S. citizens and those in the country legally. Former IRS Commissioner Melanie Krause resigned over allowing ICE to submit names of people in the country illegally to the tax agency for cross-referencing. Stocks rallied sharply on Wall Street today. The Dow was up more than 1,100 points. You're listening to NPR. California Governor Gavin Newsom is urging cities and counties to clear homeless encampments. Josemay DiMaggio of member station KALW reports he unveiled a new blueprint for the local governments to enforce their own bans on public camping.
The announcement comes a year after the U.S. Supreme Court made it easier for officials to ban homeless people from camping outside. Newsom also announced the release of more than $3 billion in voter-approved funds to expand housing and treatment options. He spoke at a press conference in Sacramento.
This is a framework and the application of how to do it in a way that we think is responsible with all the supports that have come through these unprecedented investments.
The blueprint bars encampments from being in one place for more than 3 days or blocking sidewalks. local officials would need to provide notice and shelter resources before clearing an encampment. For NPR News, I'm Yosmay Del Mazo in San Francisco.
Georgia has become the second state to work towards providing protections for the makers of a popular weed killer. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signing a measure that says pesticide makers can't be sued for failing to warn customers of dangers if they use labels approved by federal regulators. Agrigiant Bayer, which bought Roundup maker Monsanto, has been hit with 181,000 claims alleging the weed killer's main ingredient causes non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Charges disputed by Bayer. The EPA also said the active ingredient, glyphosate, is not likely to be carcinogenic to humans if used as directed. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Hamas has released the last remaining U.S.-Israeli dual citizen believed to be alive and held hostage in Gaza. That is the sound of Israelis reacting to the news in central Tel Aviv. 21-year-old Idan Alexander is now back in Israel, according to the Israeli military. Hamas said the release was a step toward reaching a ceasefire agreement with Israel. President Trump called the release a, quote, step taken in good faith to end the war. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi joins us now from Tel Aviv. Hi there.
Hello.
So Hadil, tell us, what was the release like?
Well, Israelis had been waiting all day long for this, and when it happened around 6:30 p.m. Israel time, it felt quick. Hamas has been condemned in previous hostage exchanges for putting on these ceremonies with an audience, parading the hostages, making them do speeches, but none of that happened this time, and there was also no footage of the actual handover. A photograph released by Hamas later showed Alexander flanked by three armed, masked Hamas militants and a Red Cross worker. He was wearing a baseball cap and a black Adidas t-shirt, and around his neck was a lanyard with an ID-like badge with his name on it. And then the Israeli military said he was taken to a hospital for a medical assessment.
What was the reaction like in Israel?
Well, in Hostages Square in downtown Tel Aviv, that's where Israelis have been gathering and protesting in support of the hostages for more than 18 months. There, many supporters stood in front of a large TV screen for hours projecting Alexander's photo. One woman in a bright yellow pantsuit held a sign in English that said, Trump, we trust you. You know, many in the crowd credit Trump for Alexander's release, like 28-year-old medical student Samantha Block, who's a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen.
What Trump is doing in the U.S. is not acceptable in terms of immigration and reproductive rights. His office has played a role, it's undeniable, in the release of the hostages.
So that's Israel, but what was the reaction in Gaza to the news?
I mean, there was also a lot of praise in Gaza for President Trump, who Palestinians are saying will be the one who ends the war. Here's Ahmed Abu Hadid from Gaza City.
Trump warned Israel that America is the strongest.
He says Trump has shown Israel that the United States is stronger. And, you know, it's high stakes for Gaza that really needs a ceasefire. You know, Israel has been striking consistently since it broke a ceasefire in March. And for more than 10 weeks, Israel has blocked all aid, including food, from entering Gaza. And today, a report was released by a group of food security experts that said Gaza is now at risk of famine unless Israel stops its military campaign and ends the aid blockade.
Now, Hamas says this came after days of secret talks with the U.S. What can you tell us about those talks?
Well, a Hamas official spoke to NPR about this on condition of anonymity because he's not authorized to speak publicly. But he said that the U.S. made promises in exchange for Alexander's release. He hinted that it could be the release of some Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails and ensuring that some aid gets into Gaza.
Do you get the sense that a ceasefire may be on the horizon?
I mean, it's hard to say. In a statement, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said Israel did not agree to any ceasefire as a condition for Alexander's release, and it's still planning to expand its military campaign inside Gaza. But Netanyahu then said he met with the U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff today and was going to send an Israeli negotiations team to Doha tomorrow. And, you know, a lot of Israelis are mad here that it's Trump who's managing to move things forward to end the war and see the hostages released, and that it's not their own leader. You know, there's about 20 more living hostages in Gaza and the remains of dozens more.
NPR's Hadil El-Shalchi in Tel Aviv, thank you.
You're welcome.
Americans spent more than $100 billion trying their luck on the lottery last year. Among the largest systems is the Texas Lottery, but after jackpot controversies, multiple resignations, and a ban on online lotto ticket sales, the state's lottery system is now under investigation. The Texas Newsroom's Lucio Vasquez has more.
At Lucky Rudy's, a convenience store near Houston, Texas, 30-year-old Eli Sierra holds up a fresh scratch-off.
I do it every once in a while just because, like, you never know. You might win, you might not.
For Sierra and his wife, buying scratch-offs and lotto tickets has been a tradition.
I'll go buy her some flowers and I'll buy her lottery tickets just because it's like I know she loves, like, she loves the rush to be like, am I gonna win? Am I gonna win? Am I gonna win?
The Texas Lottery launched in the 90s. Just last year, it brought in more than $8 billion. Some of that helps fund public education in the state. But recent developments are shaking the foundation of the system as a whole.
Governor Abbott and I both asked for Texas Ranger investigations, and they are currently going on. The question is, should the Texas Lottery continue?
Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick says his biggest concern is online courier services, which let users buy lotto tickets without stepping into a store. Investigations began after two massive jackpots, an $83 million prize won through an online vendor, and a separate $95 million payout claimed by a group that purchased nearly every possible number combination. The Texas Lottery Commission responded by banning couriers outright, and last month, the commission's executive director resigned.
The Lottery Commission has enabled a private-public partnership led by the state agency to engage in a criminal conspiracy to defraud Texans.
That's State Senator Bob Hall. He authored a bill being considered during the Texas legislative session that would make online lottery sales a misdemeanor crime in the state. Notably, couriers didn't operate with oversight in Texas. Senator Hall says this lack of oversight has allegedly opened the door for money laundering and the sale of fake lotto tickets,
creating a criminal organization actually operating within our state government.
In a statement to NPR, the commission says its highest priority is maintaining the integrity, security, and fairness of the Texas Lottery. But the couriers say they've been legally operating for years. One of these companies is Lotto.com, which sued the state's lottery commission over the ban on couriers in late April. Rob Porter is the chief legal officer for the company.
Regulated lottery couriers support integrity and support the operations and continued growth of the Texas Lottery.
Some Texas lawmakers are exploring ways to regulate the industry, while others are pushing for the abolishment of the state lottery completely. Either way, Lieutenant Governor Patrick says whoever plays the lottery must be assured that the game is honest. Back outside Lucky Rudy's, Eli Sierra says he'll keep buying tickets for his wife, controversies or not.
It's just something that makes her happy.
After we spoke, Sierra scratched off his ticket and walked away $10 richer. For NPR News, I'm Lucio Vasquez.
Today, the jury in the federal criminal trial of Sean Combs heard opening arguments and testimony from the first of two government witnesses. The charges against Combs, better known as Diddy or Puff Daddy, include sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy. Combs pleaded not guilty to all charges. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento was in the courtroom and joins us now. And a warning, this reporting will make mention of sexual violence. Hi, Isabella.
Hi, Elsa.
So based on the opening argument, can you just give us a sense of the case that the prosecution will try to make against Combs during this trial?
The government is saying that for more than two decades, Combs used his businesses in music, fashion, and media as a criminal enterprise that carried out all sorts of alleged crimes, including kidnapping, bribery, arson, and obstruction of justice, but also sex crimes going back to 2009. These include sex trafficking and transporting commercial sex workers across state lines and abroad. So during opening arguments, prosecutor Emily Johnson alleged that Combs trafficked his ex-girlfriend, Cassie Ventura, and another girlfriend who will testify under a pseudonym. Johnson said this is not a case about a celebrity's private sexual preferences, but rather about how he used his power and influence, enabled by a loyal inner circle, to coerce and threaten women to fulfill his sexual desires.
And what about the defense? Like, what's going to be their argument against all of that?
In its opening arguments, Combs' defense said this is a case about jealousy, money, and infidelity, and that those things have nothing to do with his businesses. They admitted off the bat that Combs has a temper, that he can be violent, and he's a drug user. They say he led what may be an unconventional sex life, but they argued that's not a federal crime. Defense attorney Tenny Garrigo said Combs is responsible for domestic violence, but that all of his sexual encounters were consensual. She said the government has no business intervening in what happens in the privacy of Combs' bedrooms, and that these women were in loving yet toxic relationships with him, and none of that amounts to sex trafficking or racketeering conspiracy.
Okay. Well, the jury heard, I understand, from the first of two witnesses for the prosecution today. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, that's right. So first we heard from Israel Flores. He's currently a Los Angeles police officer, but he was working as a security guard at an LA hotel in 2016. That's when he was called to respond to an altercation between Combs and a woman he later learned was Cassie Ventura. Prosecutors today played several versions of a hotel surveillance video that's been widely viewed since CNN obtained and released a version of it last year. It shows an incident from March 2016 in which Combs can be seen kicking, hitting, and dragging Ventura down the hall. Flores testified that when he arrived to the hotel hallway, Combs had, quote, a devilish stare. He said Ventura was trying to leave, and Combs initially would not let her. Flores said that eventually, when Ventura made it out of the hotel and he was asking her if she needed help, she refused to call the police or answer any questions. The other witness was a man named Daniel Phillip. He said Ventura gave him large sums of money for having sex with her while Combs watched on numerous occasions. He was asked to describe these encounters, which he said took place in New York City between around 2012 and 2014, and he provided very graphic details about what he said took place. He also said he witnessed Combs violently attack Ventura on more than one occasion, but he did not intervene because he was scared for his own life.
Wow. Okay, well, what else do you expect from this trial for the rest of this first week?
Cassie Ventura is expected to take the stand tomorrow. She filed the first prominent civil lawsuit against Combs in the fall of 2023. They settled that lawsuit out of court within a day of its filing, but Cassie's allegations were a centerpiece of the prosecution's opening arguments, and we expect that a lot of the attention during this trial will be on her.
That is NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento. Thank you, Isabella.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. There's a park in downtown Eagle Pass, Texas, that became a focal point in tensions between the state and the Biden administration over immigration enforcement. The state of Texas took over Shelby Park more than a year ago during the peak of illegal border crossings. The park has now reopened to the public, and Eagle Pass residents say the moment is bittersweet. Texas Public Radio's Marianne Navarro has this story.
Shelby Park lies adjacent to the Rio Grande and sits right next to an international bridge connecting Eagle Pass to the Mexican city of Piedras Negras. For decades, Shelby Park was a place where people around the community gathered. Children played baseball and soccer. The sound of Tejano music blasted at yearly festivals and carnivals. Juan Cruz Moreno, a Vietnam veteran and retired teacher in Eagle Pass, remembers a time when the park used to belong to the people.
We had celebrations, and we would go over there and see the fireworks and all that stuff. So that's something that the kids remember.
That began to change as the park became a keystone for Texas Governor Greg Abbott's Operation Lone Star, an $11 billion border security crackdown. In January of 2024, during an unprecedented number of immigrant crossings along the southern border, the state of Texas fully took over the park. In December of 2023, right before the Texas National Guard cordoned off the park with concertina wire and closed the gates, U.S. Customs and Border Protection reported nearly 52,000 immigrant encounters in the Del Rio sector. That number set at just under 1,000 in March. In early April, the big black metal gates of the park quietly reopened. The soldiers retreated from the gates. But Operation Lone Star's grip is still visible here. Shipping containers and concertina wires still line the banks of the Rio Grande. Surveillance helicopters can still be seen flying over the park. Governor Abbott's office said in a statement barriers and presence on the border would remain. Additionally, the Pentagon announced in March it would send around 3,000 active duty troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. America Garcia Graywall is the co-director of the grassroots nonprofit Frontera Federation.
The state of Texas has only abandoned the gates. They have not left the park. So they still have just as much machinery and men and equipment.
Local resident Jorge Villalpando says the park used to be a place the community came together for big events, including the annual springtime festival Noches Mexicanas. Since Shelby's closure, the event has been held at a smaller nearby park, significantly reducing fundraising efforts.
Hopefully everything will go back to normal, but we don't know what's going to happen between here and then. They might close it down again.
Despite the park's reopening, residents still can't have access to the only boat ramp on the Rio Grande. Garcia Graywall says using the riverfront was an important aspect of Shelby Park.
We have no access to the river, to fishing, to the boat ramp.
Easter weekend was a popular time for families to gather near the river. Little girls in dresses posing with their baskets. This Easter, the park was quiet. Priscilla Olivares is senior policy attorney with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. She says the state's takeover of the park had an impact on Eagle Pass residents.
Wanting to access a park, wanting to access a community space is something that we can all relate to as Texans.
Villalpando questions the need to have several state and federal agents patrolling the border.
There are enough border patrols and like they used to do it. I mean, how did they do it before without all the National Guard being there?
For now, Eagle Pass residents say Shelby Park's reopening is a step forward, but they still hope for a future with baseball games, community festivals, and canoe races on the Rio Grande. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Navarro in San Antonio.
The Trump administration hopes to eliminate potentially harmful synthetic dyes used to give foods, drinks, and medicines vivid color. At a recent press event, Food and Drug Administration head Marty McCarry held up a glass of pink liquid, telling the food industry that switching to all natural alternatives should be easy.
Try watermelon juice.
But is it that simple? NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
Mark Oliveria packs a lot of pickled peppers and Italian sauces. He owns Oliveria Peppers and its football field-sized factory in Clarksburg, West Virginia, churning out 18,000 jars a day.
My father started it in 1972.
5 years ago, his grocery chain customers pointed to demand for more all-natural products. They asked Oliveria if he could remove the yellow dye number 5 he'd used in his bright yellow banana peppers. So Oliveria ran kitchen experiments. First, he used powdered turmeric root, the spice that makes curry so easily stain clothes.
It took me a little while to get the color exact because within 6 to 8 weeks in the jar, it would start lightening up. So the first year we had a little bit of tough time, and it was mainly because we were using the powdered form, which didn't hold its color as long.
He then found a liquid turmeric dye that was pricier and required more quantity, but worked perfectly.
It is a little bit more expensive to use the turmeric, but we were able to take the yellow dye number 5 off our label.
Doing so 5 years ago put Oliveria ahead of the curve. Europe and Canada since adopted stricter food dye rules. The U.S. banned red dye number 3 in January, and now the Trump administration says it wants food, beverage, and pharmaceutical industries to voluntarily eliminate all petroleum-based dyes by the end of next year. The FDA recently approved 3 new all-natural dyes for manufacturers to use instead. But switching isn't necessarily simple. Melissa Wright is a food safety expert at Virginia Tech University. She says extracting large volumes of color from natural sources is far more complex than mixing chemical dyes.
If you're using, you know, red cabbage extract in place of red 40, you're going to have to plant and harvest and extract raw material to get to that naturally derived color alternative, right? So first of all, you have to be able to source it.
Wright says some colors, like yellow, have lots of common natural analogs like turmeric, paprika, and annatto. Not so with blue.
Blues are going to be the really hard one. Blue, there's not a lot of naturally sourced. Supply is going to be limited, and that's going to make a difference as to what the cost is to reformulation.
It's the same for green, because it's a mix of blue and yellow. Cooking is another challenge.
These naturally derived colors tend to not be as stable, especially with heat or acid. So if you're adding them to acidic sodas or you're adding them to products that you have to heat, it's going to become a problem because they're just not going to be as vivid as the customer is used to seeing.
Loyal consumers can vocally revolt when cherry flavors suddenly turn dull purple or cheese snacks appear more rust-colored than safety tape yellow.
When I eat Doritos and Cheetos, I have that orange dust on my fingers, right? And if you don't have that, is it really a Dorito eating experience, you know?
Mark Oliveria sees that preference for color with pickles, too. The cauliflower he dyes bright yellow with turmeric sells far better than his vegetable mix with no dye at all.
But I will tell you that my cauliflower sells way more, so people like that. They like that color. 90% of the people eat with their eyes, and I think 90% of the people don't read and don't care what's in that jar.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The U.S. backed off its trade war with China for 90 days.
After productive talks in Geneva, both sides now agreed to reduce the tariffs imposed.
The U.S. and China reset tariffs almost back to where they were before President Trump's Liberation Day. So what did the U.S. gain from weeks of chaos? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. In an opera about the Central Park Five, Donald Trump is a villain. The director speaks about staging it during this presidential administration.
It was not me thinking I should tone it down. It was me making a decision that the central story is about these boys.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump said tariffs on imported pharmaceuticals will soon be announced. As Jackie Fortier with KFF Health News tells us, small pharmacy owners are anxious.
Arkansas pharmacist Scott Pace expects the amount he has to pay for generic drugs to go up.
That's really a scary proposition on an industry that's already on razor-thin margins.
Regardless of the shape the tariffs take, unless insurers raise the amount they reimburse for those drugs, more independent pharmacies could close. Industry officials say tariffs on pharmaceuticals are unlikely to bring back domestic manufacturing of generic drugs. The U.S. has typically imported vast amounts of generics from India, Europe, and China.
That's Jackie Fortier with our partner KFF Health News. Speaking in Newark this afternoon, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says he will meet with representatives from major airlines and federal officials this week to discuss repeated air traffic control problems in the Northeast.
The DOT will convene a delay reduction meeting this Wednesday with all airlines who have flights at Newark. The goal is to have a manageable number of flights land at Newark. Families shouldn't have to wait 4 or 5 hours for a flight that never takes off.
Those problems have caused a ripple effect on flights nationwide. Duffy says this week's meeting will likely determine how many flights will be allowed to originate from Newark Airport for the rest of the summer. California's Governor Gavin Newsom says it's time for cities and counties here to take immediate action to clear homeless encampments that have been banned in the state. Newsom ratcheting up his push on enforcing the ban, saying the state will offer money and a plan to relocate those living in cars, tents, or outdoors. A record 187,000 people were homeless in California last year. This is NPR. New research shows the obesity drug Zepbound appears to help people lose more weight than Wegovy. NPR's Rob Stein has more on the study.
Researchers studied 751 obese volunteers who got weekly injections of either Zepbound or Wegovy. In results published in the New England Journal of Medicine and reported at the European Congress on Obesity in Spain, the researchers found that those who got Zepbound lost more weight over the next 18 months than those who got Wegovy. The volunteers who got Zepbound lost an average of about 20% of their body weight. Those taking Wegovy lost an average of about 14%. The study was funded by Eli Lilly, which makes Zepbound. Novo Nordisk makes Wegovy. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Businesses that rely on Chinese-made imports are expressing both relief and anxiety over a 90-day tariff pause. Chinese imports will be reduced from 145% to 30%, and China will cut tariffs on American products from 125% down to 10%. The two sides plan to continue negotiations on a longer-term deal. Many U.S. companies canceled or even delayed orders after President Trump's escalating taxes on Beijing well ahead of the holiday shopping center, or rather, season. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump is heading to the Middle East tonight. He's promised to make multi-billion dollar deals that benefit the U.S. and help it reassert its regional role. NPR's Aya Betraoui reports from Riyadh on how Trump will lean into his personal ties, too.
Few places in the world exemplify new money aesthetic and luxury quite like the Arab Gulf. Think towering skyscrapers with infinity pools and luxury interiors. The market's crowded with designer hotels and residences, and that includes Trump-branded real estate projects popping up. I stopped by Dar Global's office in Riyadh. That's the private Saudi developer behind the newest Trump projects in the region. There's a mock-up of a 47-story Trump Tower coming up in the Saudi city of Jeddah.
Trump Clubhouse? How many apartments is it?
Around 450.
Dar Global's also developing a sprawling Trump golf course and residential community in Oman. And only weeks ago, the Trump Organization launched two more projects with the company, a Trump golf course community in Doha, Qatar, and a hotel tower in Dubai where penthouses are priced at $20 million. Here's Eric Trump, the president's son who runs the family business, in a video from Dar Global at the launch of the hotel tower project in Dubai.
On behalf of myself, on behalf of my family, we love Dubai. We have such a great relationship between the United States and just one of the greatest places.
It's not just love and friends that draw the Trump family to the Gulf. There's big dollar investments fueled by the region's oil wealth. And this confluence of personal ties, business interests, and Trump's role as president of the United States converge on this trip, where he'll meet with the rulers of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE. While president, Trump's investments and assets are in a trust managed by his children. But Mamoun Fendi, director of the London Global Strategy Institute think tank, says these family business deals compromise the image of the office he holds.
In the past, the presidency used to cost the president his financial well-being, if you will, that most people have to declare their assets and make sure they are separated from his office. Now everything is conflated.
Since his first term in office, money from the Gulf has flowed into the Trump family's orbit. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, secured a $2 billion investment from Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund overseen by the Saudi crown prince. It helped Kushner launch his private equity fund just months after leaving the White House, where he was advisor to Trump in his first term. The White House says Trump isn't making money off being president. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told reporters it's ridiculous to even suggest it.
He left a life of luxury and a life of running a very successful real estate empire for public service, not just once, but twice.
Just before heading to the Gulf, Trump was asked by reporters about being offered a new presidential luxury Boeing plane from Qatar to replace one of the aging Air Force One jets.
I would never be one to turn down that kind of an offer. I mean, I could be a stupid person say, no, we don't want a free, very expensive airplane.
Meanwhile, money from the Gulf keeps coming. The latest deal included the Trump family's cryptocurrency venture called World Liberty Financial. It's co-founded by Zach Witkoff, whose father is Steve Witkoff, Trump's special envoy to the Mideast. Just days ago, an Abu Dhabi firm used World Liberty's stablecoin to close a $2 billion investment into crypto exchange Binance. So what exactly do Gulf Arab states gain from these investments? Fendi of the London Global Strategy Institute says it's part of a bigger calculus to establish close links with a sitting U.S. president.
It works for them as a security umbrella. It's a high premium, but still a security insurance policy.
And for Saudi Arabia, a heavyweight in the region and a major oil producer, having Trump choose to come here first for his first official trip again as president cements their regional clout. And that, Fendi says, is priceless. Aya Betraoui, NPR News, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
The Justice Department's Civil Rights Division is in upheaval. The new Trump-appointed leadership is trying to dramatically reshape it and its mission. That has prompted a mass exodus of attorneys from the Civil Rights Division, which has been regarded as a crown jewel of the DOJ. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is here in the studio. Hey, Ryan.
Hey there.
So, Ryan, let's start with the Justice Department's leadership. What do they say they're doing with the Civil Rights Division?
So, first off, the Civil Rights Division has been around for almost 70 years. It was born out of the Civil Rights Movement and the push to end segregation. And traditionally, the division has protected the constitutional rights of all Americans. It combats discrimination in schools, in public housing, in the workplace, in policing, hate crimes. And it's normal for the priorities of the division to shift a bit from administration to administration, particularly from Republican to Democratic administration. But what's happening now is something entirely different. Here's how Harmeet Dhillon, the new head of the division, appointed by Trump, described her vision for civil rights enforcement at a recent event with the Conservative Federalist Society.
We don't just slow down the woke. We take up the cause to achieve the executive branch's goals. This is the opportunity where we can ensure that our nation's civil rights laws benefit all Americans, not just a select few.
So, Ryan, what does that look like in practice so far?
Well, I've talked with five current and former Justice Department officials. Some of them spoke on condition of anonymity because they aren't allowed to talk to journalists. And they all describe this very differently from how Dhillon does. They say that Dhillon, quite simply, is dismantling the Civil Rights Division and its traditional mission. One described it as taking an axe to the division. And they say that under the Trump administration, the division is largely abandoning its traditional mission of enforcing the nation's civil rights laws for all Americans. And instead, it's being turned into an enforcement arm of the administration. And its new mission largely is to enforce President Trump's executive orders. So things like ending the purported radical indoctrination in schools, defending women from gender ideology extremism, combating anti-Semitism and alleged anti-Christian bias. And what that has done, I'm told, has prompted this mass exodus that we're seeing of experienced attorneys from the division.
You say mass exodus. How big of a group are we talking about here?
Well, I'm told that more than 70% of the attorneys who were at the Civil Rights Division on Inauguration Day have left or will have left by the end of this month. That's approximately 250 attorneys.
Huh.
That is a huge number. Some of the hardest hit sections, I'm told, are education, voting rights, special litigation. That last one is the section that investigates alleged abuse by police departments around the country. And people are leaving in a variety of ways. Some have just quit. Some have taken the administration's deferred resignation program. Others have retired early. But the effect is significant. I spoke with former DOJ attorney Stacey Young. She spent the last chunk of her 18-year career in the Civil Rights Division before leaving after Trump's inauguration.
It's absolutely the dismantling of the division. When in just a couple months, you have radically diverted enforcement in a way that drives out almost three quarters of the division, there's no other way to describe that but a dismantling.
Now, attorneys in the division, by and large, feel that they cannot do the sort of work that they've always been able to do, and that includes during the first Trump administration.
Okay, well, I mean, there's just been so much change, a lot of upheaval across the federal government right now. So tell us, why does this particular bit of turmoil stand out?
That's a good question, and the answer that I've heard in my reporting is, in essence, that for decades, the Civil Rights Division has put employers and schools and owners of public housing and police departments on notice that if they don't comply with civil rights laws, if they discriminate, they could face legal action. And so without the division doing that work, department veterans say there will likely be more unlawful discrimination in all facets of life across the country. That's just going to go unchecked.
NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Film legend Gérard Depardieu receives a verdict tomorrow over sexual assault charges. Two women say that he groped them on a film set in 2021. Many see the decision as a moment to restart France's Me Too movement. NPR's Rebecca Rossman reports from Paris.
For decades, Gérard Depardieu played what the French call le coquin, flirtatious, provocative, and proud of it. Like here, speaking on the BBC talk show Graham Norton in 2012.
I love women, but I don't know if they love me, but I respect. I respect that, but I'd love to have a conversation and to make you some kind of humor and to touch sometimes.
Yes.
But 5 years later, in 2017, the Me Too movement happened, changing the way people talked about power, consent, and accountability. Women's rights advocates have accused the French justice system of being slower to confront its powerful men, and slower still to believe the women who come forward. Karine Durieux-Dibol is a lawyer representing one of the two women in this trial.
Il y a environ 25 femmes.
She says more than 20 women have accused Gérard Depardieu of sexual misconduct, including groping, harassment, and rape. But because of France's statute of limitations, only two of those cases were recent enough to go to trial. The two women say Depardieu touched them inappropriately on a film set in 2021.
La victoire d'une ou de deux victimes, ça sera la victoire de toutes.
Durieux-Dibol says if there's a guilty verdict on Tuesday, it will be a victory not just for the women in court, but for all others who were silenced by time. During the four-day trial in March, Depardieu testified that he was a man out of step with modern times. He admitted to using vulgar language on set, saying he now avoids female assistants in dressing rooms so as not to be misunderstood. But he denies being a sexual abuser. "I try not to be heard by the new world," he said. "I think my time is done." If convicted, Depardieu faces an 18-month suspended prison sentence and up to a $221,000 fine. Depardieu has high-level supporters.
Moi, je suis un grand admirateur de Gérard Depardieu.
French President Emmanuel Macron said on French TV channel TV5 last year that he admired Depardieu's work as an actor.
Il y a une chose dans lesquelles vous ne me verrez jamais.
When asked about calls to strip him of the Legion of Honor, the president warned against what he called a, quote, witch hunt. An outcry ensued. Macron reacted later by saying he would be uncompromising in talking issues of rape and what he called this culture of brutality. Still, many in France see this trial as a test of the country's willingness to take sexual violence seriously.
First and foremost, because it's a test of the moral independence of the justice system.
Elodie Tueyon-Ibone is a lawyer and legal analyst focused on how France's justice system handles sexual violence. She says Depardieu is a symbol.
A symbol of what we no longer want to see in France. And I would say of France itself, this so-called, you know, buttiness, this so-called gallantry, which in reality is aggression or harassment.
In other words, she says, the question now isn't just what Depardieu did, but what French society is willing to call it. Rebecca Ralsman, NPR News, Paris.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. A new exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York looks at Black dandyism. It focuses on clothing from the 18th century to contemporary Black designers, and it inspired the recent Met Gala theme, Superfine, Tailoring Black Style. Fashion is often described as an individualistic pursuit, but WNYC's Amanda Rozon spoke with some designers who share how their families influence their pieces.
The pants is actually named after my father, Kingsley, because I loved his style back in the day. I wanted to commemorate his swag.
Samuel Boachi is standing next to a mannequin that's wearing a long coat in a patterned yellow and sunburst orange, layered over burnt orange bootcut pants. He says his clothing line, Kwasi Paul, draws from his family's native Ghana.
I was really inspired by it because when they came to this country, it wasn't easy. But just by looking at the pictures, you can still see like the joy, even just in how they dress.
Boachi's one of the designers highlighted in the exhibition, Superfine, Tailoring Black Style. Co-curator Monica Miller says a Black dandy is an elegant dresser who challenges social norms.
Not only is the dandy somebody who pushes boundaries, and particularly in relationship to class, gender, sometimes sexuality, but then, you know, when you think about the dandy as racialized as Black, he's also pushing boundaries of what might seem acceptable.
Think Prince or Janelle Monáe.
We think about dandyism as a strategy and a tool of self-definition, but also an art.
Another outfit featured is by the London-based designer Nicholas Daly. He says he's most proud of the shoes. A pair of loafers and a patchwork of beige and browns that he created with the shoe brand Clarks.
My granddad, he was a shoemaker in Jamaica.
An orange and red beret on the mannequin's head was knitted by Daly's mother.
So yeah, it's like mum on the top, dad on the bottom, and everything in the middle.
The exhibition runs at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City through October. For NPR News, I'm Amanda Rozon in New York.
An opera about the Central Park Five is now on stage in Detroit. The opera won the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 2020. It's based on a real-life story about a group of Black and brown teenagers wrongly charged and sent to prison for a brutal attack on a female jogger in New York City's Central Park in 1989. Back then, Donald J. Trump was not yet president, but he took out full-page newspaper ads demanding the death penalty for the young men. Those men were eventually exonerated. Trump is a villain in the opera, and NPR's Netta Ulaby spoke with its producers about staging it during this administration.
Are we starting with music?
At a recent rehearsal for the opera called the Central Park Five, singers in sweatpants and baseball caps warmed up by a piano. The story they are performing has been told many times since the young men, who were mostly only 14 and 15 years old at the time of their arrests, were exonerated in 2002. There's been a PBS documentary and an Emmy Award-winning Netflix miniseries, but composer Anthony Davis heard an opera in the depths of this drama.
I wanted the audience to empathize and to identify with the five.
Raymond Santana, Kevin Richardson, Antron McRae, Corey Weiss, Yusuf Salam. Davis wanted to express their individual personalities on stage, but he says it was also a musical opportunity.
So it gave me a chance, for example, to do five-part harmony. When they sing together, I was thinking of how people sing on the street, coming from gospel traditions, and also from groups like Boyz II Men and Take Six.
This scene takes place after the five teenagers have been brought to the police station.
Can we go home? Can we go home?
They were held 36 hours without food and water and interrogated mercilessly.
Even before composer Anthony Davis won the Pulitzer Prize, he was acclaimed for writing operas like one about Malcolm X that premiered here in Detroit and was staged recently by the Metropolitan Opera. This, the third production of the Central Park Five, was planned by the Detroit Opera 3 years ago, says its conductor, Anthony Parnther.
I can't think of an opera that is more technically daunting.
Parnther also conducted the score for the hit movie Sinners, now in theaters. Both works, he says, draw from an incredible range of American musical idioms. The Central Park Five incorporates jazz, R&B, and of course, modernist classical music.
It really requires such an ear from every single singer. They basically have to physically memorize all of these very complex rhythms and these very difficult to predict pitches.
The hardest part in the opera, he says, belongs to a female character, the assistant district attorney.
I mean, all of the parts are difficult, but I think the DA has the spikiest part. The voicing is brutal.
The opera's action is driven by music sung by characters representing the legal system, says Nataki Garrett. She's directing the Detroit Opera's production of the Central Park Five.
Embedded in the music is a kind of metronome feeling, and there's a mechanism that is moving, and their jobs are a part of this machine. And so there's something in the music that reminds you that this is the system working as it was supposed to work. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do, and you can feel that in the music.
The first time the Central Park Five was staged in 2019, there was an aria sung by the character Donald Trump calling for the death penalty while he sits on a golden toilet. That staging is not in this production. I asked director Nataki Garrett if there was a decision to tone it down.
Not for me. It was not me thinking I should tone it down. It was me making a decision that the central story is about these boys.
Frankly, the focus should be on the five and not on him.
Composer Anthony Davis. He says Trump remains an important part of the Central Park Five opera and shows audiences part of his path to the presidency.
That was the beginning of Donald Trump's political career, was Central Park Five.
Trump is a character in another opera Davis is writing right now. It's based on a children's book called Pancho Rabbit and the Coyote, A Migrant's Tale. It's set on the southern border. All the characters are animals. Trump is a golden snapping turtle. Davis says opera is a way to reflect history back to ourselves, and in the case of the Central Park Five, to be reminded that justice comes from determined work.
I think the message of the opera is one of their perseverance.
And empathy and hope. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE, price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the...